You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, smash and grab, the Trump administration's pathway to a borderless empire of impunity, a homeland empire. The GPM speaks with American historian Nikhil Pal Singh. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, help us out. Subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor at greenplanetmonitor.net. From Caracas to Minnesota, from Iran and Cuba to the streets of Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York City, from the Persian Gulf to the waters of the Eastern Pacific, Donald Trump and his henchmen are collapsing U.S. domestic and foreign policing into a single domain of impunity where anything goes, where Pete Hegseth, Marco Rubio, and U.S. Homeland Security chiefs commit uber violence suddenly, kinetically, and dramatically, turning violence and murder into spectacle, smash and grab operations staged for instant transmission to the American public and the world on Donald Trump's social media platform, Truth Social. In a recent article for the journal Equator, American historian Nikhil Pal Singh unpacks the Trump regime's real innovation, expanding the borders of U.S. state power, collapsing foreign and domestic violence into a single domain of impunity, homeland empire, Singh calls this. Nikhil Pal Singh is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU in New York City. The intersection of contemporary U.S. history and political theory is what interests him the most. The GPM sat down with Nikhil Pal Singh at his office at NYU. You've just written an article for recently for the journal Equator entitled Homeland Empire. And I'm wondering what you mean by homeland empire. You say here, Donald Trump's real innovation has been to marry the archaic geopolitics of a settler empire to the modern legal frameworks devised by his liberal predecessors. What distinguishes his latest regime is its effort to reimagine and remake the borders of American state power, collapsing the foreign and the domestic in a single domain of impunity called its homeland empire. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this? What do you mean?
Yeah, homeland empire is an effort on my part to create what we might call a new background image for thinking about how the U.S. is reimagining its place in the world in the current moment. So I'm not really saying that there is something like a homeland empire that actually exists, as much as I'm using it as a conceit, as a heuristic. So first you have to remember that I wrote this piece before the current war in Iran. So it was back in January when it was published. And at that time, the two things that were on my mind and the two things that were very visible in the public sphere were the ICE and CBP kind of military style occupation in Minneapolis, which followed upon similar actions in Chicago and Los Angeles. And secondly, the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro by U.S. military forces from Venezuela, and whisked him out of the country and brought him to New York City for trial on drug trafficking charges. So I was thinking about these two events, one in the what we might call the hemispheric domain of American power that has typically been imagined under the Monroe Doctrine, which was declared in the middle of the 19th century, and Trump himself invoked that recently to explain his understanding of the U.S. relationship to Latin America and to the hemisphere. already there you can see a kind of a reaching back into an archaic, for an archaic precedence in the 19th century. And then the ICE and CBP operations in the American interior to essentially round up, detain, deport, kind of clear the population of undesirable, unwanted foreign elements is something that is not entirely new in the sense that deportation, mass deportation, has been part of the American project going back several decades now. But we haven't seen deportation operations in the American interior, uprooting settled communities, long settled families. I haven't really seen this scale of operation in these places until recently. So those to me are reminiscent of something like the kind of clearing operations that we might think of as part of the American past, that were very much focused on the imagination of the country as a territorial space, a continental space. And so when you put these two things together, when you think of kind of the United States not as a global empire, right, not as a country that has kind of far-reaching and sort of abstract commitments all over the world in the name of kind of securing a rule-bound order, which is really how the post-war American imperium was imagined and created. But you see now something like a kind of a shrinking of that to an older model of territorial empire focused on the continental United States, and a kind of hemispheric domain in which the United States rules informally over its immediate neighbors and its environs. Okay, so homeland empire really is an attempt to kind of think about how under Trump there's a retreat from globalism, there's an interest in kind of reshoring national security, there's a focus on essentially exerting power over weaker neighbors, and there's a focus on what Trump himself has called the enemy within, right? The sort of particularly this has been aimed at immigrants who are you know seen as unauthorized to be in the United States, but you know there's a very broad attack on immigration now in the United States under Trump and the far right.
And there's a revisioning of the existential threat that America faces. It's no longer exclusively from abroad,
right,
from America's traditional official enemies.
Right.
The threat is actually coming from inside the country.
That's the vision, exactly. That's the sensibility that Trump has sought to cultivate. And that's very central to the political dynamics on the right today. So that marriage of the archaic, these sort of reaching back into the 19th century for precedence, you know, kind of white supremacist settler colonial society that rules over the hemisphere, right? You can see how that kind of imagery is sort of part of the way that the Trump administration and the right wants to kind of rethink the American place in the world. And Pete Hegseth, who's the Secretary of Defense, laid that out recently quite clearly, where he said, you know, the Trump administration is imagining a new perimeter of American security. Okay, so all of this might seem to be somewhat contradicted by the Iran war, and maybe we'll get to that later. But these archaic elements are married to what I've called the sort of more contemporary dimensions of American power, in which Trump is quite consistent with previous American leaders and presidents, which is that he's exercising the prerogatives of the imperial presidency. He's exercising the prerogatives of a massive, bloated national security complex, which has developed over 75 years and has allowed American presidents to enact a lot of discretion in domains of national security. So Trump has this apparatus at his disposal, and he's used it. He's used it in ways that other American presidents have used it, right? So,
and this apparatus has been developed, the ways and means of exerting power around the world and projecting American imperial power militarily have been kind of brought home.
Yeah.
And I recall that, you know, even as far back as the end of the Vietnam War, people were talking about how the war, this massive technological advancement, if you can use that word, to be able to wage wars around the world have been actually brought home. There's all this infrastructure that's been built, let's use it. And certainly they were talking about this back in the early 2000s in the wake of the war on Iraq and the war on Afghanistan, and that we would see, and we are indeed seeing, the militarization of American domestic police forces,
yes,
which are indistinguishable on the streets of Minneapolis or anywhere else, New York City, from boots on the ground in Afghanistan.
That's exactly right. So that's another way in which you can say, on the one hand, Trump's, as our conversation has noted already, is reaching into the far past and into these kind of archaic, kind of almost strange sort of ideas about, you know, and they bring forth things that seem out of the blue, like suddenly you're going to imagine what, taking Greenland or annexing part of Canada or starting a war with Mexico. All of these things really are kind of, again, in the vein of sort of 19th century territorial expansionism, which we didn't really imagine was coming back. Okay, but Trump is hearkening to these things and seems to be even indicating that they may be on the table, right? But the more obvious and sort of clear precedents for what he's doing have as you rightly say, been developing over really the last 50 years. In the aftermath of the Vietnam War, you really do see a kind of turning inward of the security apparatus. I mean, the Vietnam War itself was described as a quote-unquote police action, as were most American wars after World War II. Not declared wars, but actions to kind of police the globe, and that sort of sense of policing and a kind of omnipresent and sort of necessary focus on police power everywhere becomes much more internally focused after the Vietnam War. And you really see that, especially starting in the 1980s with the war on crime, the war on drugs. Through the Reagan and Clinton eras, the American prison population goes from being about 200,000 to 300,000 people to being almost 2 million people. The United States becomes the largest prison nation on the planet. In terms of the numbers of people incarcerated, and you always have to multiply the numbers of people incarcerated by the numbers of people arrested, by their various relationships to people in communities who lose a family member to prison, lose a wage earner to prison. So there are immense collateral consequences to the way in which the United States begins to develop along these lines in terms of the investment in policing. And one of the things I wrote about in my last book, Race in America's Long War, is the way in which American police themselves are beginning to reimagine themselves as people who are fighting wars in relationship to the domestic population. So someone like Daryl Gates, who becomes the police chief of Los Angeles, one of the most, you know, paramilitary, kind of vicious police forces that that we see in any urban area of the United States, and we certainly can track that back to the mid-1960s or forward to the LA riots of 1992. Well, before Gates becomes the police chief of the LAPD, he's a police officer, and he describes in his memoir how they were studying the counterinsurgency tactics of Marines and in kind of local areas in California near Los Angeles. Because, as he put it, quote unquote, the American streets had become a foreign territory, right? So that idea that, like, the police are actually not agents of our kind of civic life who are related to the people that they're policing, but that are actually mounting a kind of operation against a foreign enemy, right? That does begin to creep into American thinking, into American police practice, as you say, in the 1970s and 1980s. So, and of course, it helps build this entire prison apparatus. And then we can see that ratcheted up again after 9/11 with the development of the Department of Homeland Security, because that's an entirely new government department. It licenses mass surveillance of the American population. It begins to blur this distinction between the foreign and the domestic, the idea that the threats are overseas rather than proximate. Although George Bush says one of the reasons we're going to fight the global war on terror is because we want to fight the terrorists over there so we don't have to fight them at home, there's already an indication there that that line is being destabilized. And of course, one of the things you begin to see in the early 2000s is the right beginning to kind of refocus its attention and its animus on the immigration question, precisely in relationship to the global war on terror. The idea that the people who are coming into the country across the border, you know, might be harboring, you know, interest in harming the people of the United States, might be bearing kind of foreign ideologies, might be forming sleeper cells, all of these kinds of conspiratorial ways of thinking really begin to stoke and create the anti-immigrant panic. And of course, the Bush administration creates the concept of the homeland as the site of defense. So you have these kind of layers developing, the war on crime, the war on terror, and then, of course, eventually with Trump, we get the war on migrants. And all of these layers work together in the sense that they're imaginatively related, they're ideologically related, and they're institutionally related. And one of the things you see happening now with the Trump war on migrants is these are really being knitted together. I mean, one of the things the Trump administration is doing, and I wrote about this in the article, is it's creating all of these agreements with local police to deputize them as immigration agents. So it's not only investing huge amounts of money in the Department of Homeland Security and hiring new personnel, but it's sort of integrating the Department of Homeland Security with this kind of capillary structure of American policing.
So it's a whole government approach is the term you use.
Yeah, exactly. A whole government approach.
And alcohol, tobacco, and firearms and...
There's been an absorbing of other police agencies who are supposed to be focused on other things, ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, the FBI, even the IRS, right, which is obviously not a policing agency per se, the Internal Revenue Service. There's this whole government approach which involves, you know, kind of knitting together existing policing agencies that are focused on many, many different things from, you know, child trafficking to illegal guns, to white-collar crime, to, you know, the various things that, you know, bedevil our country. And they're being kind of pulled off it for kind of immigration-related policing. And then they're also sitting atop this kind of larger apparatus that is now being sort of brought together underneath it by connecting up with kind of local and state police and local and state prison and detention operations, because that's the other dimension of it, which is that you already have this prison infrastructure, but you're kind of repurposing it for immigration detention and then sort of building it out even further by retrofitting, you know, logistics warehouses, you know, in middle America to like put several thousand detainees or several hundred detainees, you know, and then citing those near an airfield where they can then be quickly moved and deported somewhere else, you know, and it's just a lot of this is just happening kind of under cover of darkness, you know. It's obviously we've seen the visible operations, and they've engendered a lot of pushback. But there's a steady build out of this project that's been happening over the last 2 years, and it's very concerning in terms of where it could head.
And I was just reading the other day, I don't have the details, but I think a couple of dozen or more U.S. senators have filed some kind of a complaint because the spiriting away of these immigrants has now become totally black box.
Yeah.
That there's no information about them.
Yeah.
About, you know, who they are, where they've been sent, and the flights are now, I don't know how one does this technologically, but one switches off the transmission systems in the aircraft. So there's no way of knowing where people are going and who they are and where they're being sent.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like straight out of Stalinist Russia.
Yeah, and the more proximate, you know, sort of precedent for it was Extraordinary Rendition in the Global War on Terror, you know, which was a huge scandal that the CIA and the national security agencies were just kind of kidnapping people. Of course, a lot of this was happening from third countries overseas, and then they were being whisked to some prison somewhere where they could, or some American military site or some proxy site where they could be interrogated and often, of course, tortured. But that idea that people could just be seized and there's no record of them and the flights were secret and everything was off books. I mean, this was happening on a scale that had never occurred before during the Global War on Terror. But in a certain way, it's created the model for what they're doing now.
What does Donald Trump have against immigrants?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll reframe the question into just a kind of a broader one, which is that how has nativism become so central in a country that really, until maybe 10, 15 years ago, and even maybe in some ways today still, we would say is a nation of immigrants, a nation that was created by immigrants, a nation that was defined by waves of mass migration from different parts of the world. There's a long history of immigration in the United States. There's waves of immigration in the 19th century. Certainly the Irish come en masse in the middle of the 19th century. There's a big wave of immigration that comes with the advent of kind of America as an industrial society. Many of them come from Southern and Eastern Europe. They're not Protestants. They're Catholics and Jews, many of them. So there's a kind of a process of kind of continued transformation of the country through immigration. The United States fights wars on its southern border in the 19th century, which annex huge parts of Mexico. So you have a large population of people who are previously Mexican, who become part of the United States. So from kind of its founding till 1924, you have massive waves of immigration which create the country. In 1924, immigration restriction is passed. There's a national origins immigration law, and that's something that nativists in the United States have been agitating for from the turn of the 20th century, and they finally win. And essentially, they close down mass migration from Europe. They kind of block any migration from certain parts of the world. They create what is called the Asiatic Barred Zone, because there had been some immigration, especially from China and East Asia in the late part of the 19th century, that was part of that mass migration that I described just a minute ago. So the nativists win in 1924, and they win by codifying a pretty racist set of immigration laws, including the idea that future immigration will be determined based upon the census of 1890, which will create national origins quotas. And the idea behind that is to essentially limit further immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, which is where a lot of people had come from, but also to limit any immigration from parts of the British Empire, so essentially no black immigration. And then, of course, they have the Asiatic Barred Zone. So there's multiple kind of ways that they're trying to sort of reframe immigration in 1924 as something that is kind of harmful to the country and that has sort of destroyed its kind of natural hierarchy and its demographic kind of groundedness in white Northern Europe and in a white Northern European population. So it's a racist immigration law, essentially. But that immigration law, which really stays on the books until 1965, and of course there's a period of two world wars there, which have a huge impact, does essentially like freeze immigration in the United States for a period of time. But what happens in the interim 40 years is that this massive foreign-born population becomes, you know, increasingly Americanized. They have children. The country becomes much more diverse. In the 1930s, of course, we see with the rise of the New Deal, the rise of a very powerful labor movement, which is multi-ethnic and multiracial. And the sense of what the country is actually changing and really militating against the sort of nativist view. So by the 1930s and the 1940s, you have a kind of idea of the United States beginning to emerge as a nation of nations, as a universal nation, as humanity writ small. There is a clear recognition, particularly by the 1940s, that diversity is America's strength, and that American pretensions to become the leader or kind of hegemon of the world to sort of help establish a rule-bound order after World War II is very much predicated upon the idea that the United States has proven itself as a nation-state capable of incorporating diverse populations, of eliminating hierarchies on the basis of national origin, on the basis of race, on the basis of religion. All of these begin to kind of go by the wayside. Right, and you see a period of reform after World War II of American citizenship law. The biggest reforms, of course, happen in the sphere of civil rights and eliminating racial segregation. But one of the big reforms that begins to happen is you get the elimination of these national origins restrictions in immigration, and you begin to have the idea that, again, which has been true going back to the founding, that what makes America great is the idea that theoretically anyone can be an American, that to be an American is not a matter of blood and rank and birth and heritage, but it's a matter of kind of a certain ideal, a certain set of values, a certain commitments to freedom, certainly notions of individuality and being judged by your character and by your merit and by your achievements. And all of these aspects, right, are kind of central to the kind of liberal reform project of the post-war period that lead to the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which liberalizes American immigration law. So in the 1960s, because of the long period of immigration restriction from the 1920s, only about 5% of the country is foreign-born by the 1960s. But now, today, in the intervening period in which you've seen a lot more immigration into the United States since that law was passed, and we're still talking over 60 years, the United States is about 15% foreign-born. Okay? So that means in a country of 330 million people, you've got about 45 million foreign-born people, right? That math's about right. Maybe 50 million foreign-born people. So it's a big number, and you know, part of what happens, particularly after the 1960s, and it's not strictly related to the liberalization of immigration law, is that you have more migration across the southern border. Some of that is unauthorized migration. Some of that's a result of, you know, economic policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has a huge disruptive effect on kind of Mexican agriculture. And then you also have immigration that results from American military involvement overseas, right? So the American military is involved in all parts of the world. There's a significant migration from Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War as a result of the disruptions that the United States engenders there. And there are migrations from Central America that have been related to, again, American policies in that region. There have obviously been migrations from the Middle East and from West Asia, and so forth, right? So,
and largely driven by climate change.
Driven by climate change, driven by economic destabilization, driven by war, and enabled in some sense by a relatively generous American refugee and asylum policy, which has again been linked to the longer period of liberalization of American immigration law. So there's no gainsaying the fact that after the 1960s, the United States becomes again an even more diverse country, a country that is whose immigration streams, many of them are coming from the non-European world. Some of that immigration is, again, unauthorized immigration, which creates a certain issue around the border. But by and large, the sense of the country, I would say, at least until maybe the early 2000s, is still ruled by this kind of liberal conception that the United States is a nation of immigrants, that people who come here assimilate into the country, that they become part of its fabric, that they help it to prosper by through their own efforts and initiatives. Okay? And I think, honestly, David, that idea is still probably